Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Purina and their certified therapy dogs like Hanley. Say hi, Hanley! Hanley is one of 30 therapy dogs Purina has helped get certified to support kids struggling with their mental health. Purina employees are volunteering their time and family pets like Hanley to help make pet therapy more accessible to patients, students, and kids like me. Learn more about Purina's pet therapy program at purina.com/mental health.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we're talking with Library Director Susan Cusell about her viral tweet. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you so much, Christina. I really appreciate the invitation and delighted to join you.
I am so glad that you're here and that we get to talk about your tweet and what was behind it. But before we clue listeners into what that even means, will you please tell us about yourself?
Sure. I have a very, I wear a lot of hats. So I have a very interesting, portfolio of jobs that I do simultaneously. So as you mentioned, I am a library director of a synagogue library in the Washington, D.C. area. I am also an author. I recently published a picture book called The Passover Guest from Holiday House and Neil Porter Books, illustrated by Sean Rubin. And I'm a bookstore consultant. So I work with bookstores, particularly those who are just starting up, and help them get everything in order to begin. I'm also an author consultant, but in kind of a long range planning mode of where people who are children's authors who are trying to sort of sort out their career and the next steps in their career. And until just a couple of months ago, I was a book buyer at a independent bookstore and helped select their books.
One of the things I love to learn from my guests is about their own journey through higher ed. Would you be willing to take us back to perhaps high school when you were looking ahead to college? Did you know you wanted to go to college? What did you want to study? And how did you get from there to where you are now?
Oh, I have an interesting journey through higher ed. I don't think anyone's asked me that question so directly, but I have a lot to say about it.
We're here for it. Go ahead, please.
Okay, so... So you want me to start in high school? Man, we're going to be here for a while, Christina.
You don't have to. You can just start wherever is the right starting point to tell us about when you were thinking about your journey and how it went.
Well, actually, I think high school is a good place to start. Let's start with this fact, which I think is not talked about very often. And I'd like to talk about more in discussing higher ed, and it's particularly relevant to my experience. I have attention deficit disorder, and that makes it extremely difficult to get into college because pretty much all those standard things that colleges look at are things that people with ADHD do not score well on. For example, I was talented and gifted. I took honors classes, very smart and all that. But I did badly on the SATs because it's very difficult to do well on standardized tests. It's almost impossible to get extra time on those tests. So the SATs, I did badly on it. The AP classes were just too much for me. I couldn't take them, and that counted against me. And because of the workload and the homework, getting homework done. So I would work 10 times harder than anyone I knew, and I would get C's and D's and F's, and all I did was work. Everyone I knew assumed that I had A pluses because all they saw me was working. Essays were really hard because an ADHD person writes an essay like the day they're due, and they end up turning out really badly. So a lot of those standard things don't go well. Oh, and the other thing is activities. So a lot of times I'll hear them say like, oh, we'd like to see that you played the cello for 10 years and didn't start it for a year. But an ADD person does like a million activities and they don't have consistency. So all those things make it really do make it difficult to get in college. And I was rejected from pretty much every college I applied to. So it begins there.
That's painful.
It is. And I just, 30 years later, I just watched my daughter go through this exact same thing. She also has ADHD. She also got rejected from pretty much every college. And my younger son has ADHD. I'm going to have to go through the same thing in 5 years. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. Like, I know they're not going to get in. And we can talk about being inclusive when we can talk about, oh, yeah, we're all pro neurodiversity, but not really, And then when I went to college, which was at Brandeis University, I was lucky to get in, honestly. Again, a lot of people talk, we partied in college. We had friends in college. Not me. I studied Saturday night, Sunday morning. I mean, that's all I did was study, and I was still failing. And then people say, oh, you're not trying enough. You're not working hard enough. You're not applying yourself. I don't know what they're talking about. Finally, after a couple years, I got diagnosed and I got a medication prescription and I went from F's to A pluses. I actually have a letter that said, congratulations, you're no longer on academic probation, right, from the F's. And it was, and the next letter that arrived was, congratulations, you made the dean's list, because I had A pluses in every subject, because I had gone from F's to A pluses with that Ritalin prescription. But the Ritalin's not a cure-all, and you still have to really work so hard. And one of the hardest decisions I ever made was going to graduate school because to get my master's degree in library science, because I was petrified of higher education. To me, it was the hardest thing in the entire world. There was nothing harder. But in libraries, the library field, the master's degree, the MLS, is the entry-level degree. You must have it. It's like an RN or a medical degree. Like, you can't start the profession, really. Although there are other things in the profession, you really need to start it with a master's degree. And there was nothing I wanted to do less than get that master's degree. And then I get there to the school and they say, well, you're allowed no accommodations because you're in graduate school. So you must have grown out of that disability. So higher education has been challenging for me, and painful, but I will say, just absolutely killing myself in graduate school. I got a 4.0, and it's one of the biggest accomplishments of my career.
I'm just sitting here thinking of that letter, when you got off academic probation, and then the letter that came right on its heels that you were, on honor roll. Like, does that start to heal all the rejection letters to all the colleges, or do you just carry two truths equally?
You do. I mean, like, so I got that on the dean's list, but I didn't get it again. You know, it was hard to stay up at that level. I think it's just this thing that we never talk about in higher education, how hard it is for people with ADHD. It's just absolutely not discussed. My daughter is taking a gap year. So she did get into one college. She's taking a gap year. And the two of us are terrified of what that's going to look like in going to college. So many ADHD people I know, I mean, and I'm talking dozens of them, have flunked out of college. I mean, person after person after person after person. It's not created for us. I had a class in college. I was a theater and an English major, and the class met on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it was a Shakespeare class. Well, I took theater and English. Shakespeare was inevitable. And so, like, on Tuesday, you had to read, you know, Hamlet. And on Thursday, you had to read Romeo and Juliet. And on, you know, Tuesday, you had to read Tale of the Two. You had to read, you know, Merry Wives of Windsor or whatever. And to keep up with that kind of pace, you know, and you had to write papers in between. Like, that's just not a pace you can handle. And it's not about immaturity. It's not about not trying enough. It's not about not applying yourself. It's too much, you know?
It's about the cost of resilience.
Yeah.
We talk about resilience. We talk about grit. We talk about tenacity. We talk about not giving up. We don't talk about where that comes from. When they say dig down or dig deep, how much left does a human being have to excavate from themselves when you've been relying on your resilience for a long time? Resilience isn't free. It comes from somewhere within you until you're used up.
Yeah. And I mean, did we need to read 25 Shakespeare plays to get the point? I mean, you know, probably not. Anyway, so, you know, I was looking at, so the other college I got into, like I said, I got into two out of like the 8 or 10 that I applied to. And again, I know I'm smart. I know this wasn't the problem. And the other one I got into was Sarah Lawrence. And I was so excited by Sarah Lawrence because there's no grades at Sarah Lawrence. But instead of grades, they have papers due like constantly. And I couldn't handle that. So at the one hand, I was like, hey, they make this great accommodation. But on the other hand, no. Like, I can't write a paper every week. So, you know, it was very tricky to try to find somewhere that can truly accommodate. And like I said, my daughter and I are both terrified. The number of times she's come up to me and said, I'm going to flunk out of college. And I said, we're going to work on it. But, you know, she's not totally off base.
It's a scary thing for parents to send their kids off to college.
Yeah.
In any situation. And when you feel that your child won't fully be welcomed there, won't be embraced there.
Well, because in high schools, right, the teachers are like, well, that paper's not due. You owe us that paper. Well, I've noticed that you've stopped turning in your work, which every ADHD kid ever does. But in college, it's all gone. All the support, all the structure. And so you just fail. I try to talk about this as much as I can because I feel that nobody sees this and it's completely invisible. And in college, they purposely say, well, you're an adult now and we're going to take all that off. But it's the same as my graduate school saying, well, you grew out of that disability. You don't need the accommodations anymore. You're in grad school now. You need to grow up. Well, we wouldn't say that to somebody in a wheelchair. We wouldn't say, well, you just need to walk now. Come on. Invisible disabilities are the worst. They feel like it to me. Not that, of course, it's awful to be in a wheelchair, so I'm not trying to compare that, but they're just terrible. Nobody sees them, nobody expects them, nobody makes accommodations for them mentally, right? And you're constantly trying to fight for them. You're constantly trying to say, well, may I please? I beg you.
And most of the things that students ask for as accommodations are things that would make higher ed accessible for all.
Well, right. Why? I mean, I was walking around constantly asking for people for untimed tests. Why are the tests timed? If you know the material, you know the material. Does it matter if it takes me 1 hour or 2 hours to put that down on a piece of paper? I don't see why. I once took in high school a test that took everybody like an hour or two, and it was a big, important final exam. And I asked the teacher, could I have a little more time? It took me 8 hours, and I got an A++ on it. If he had stopped me at 2 hours, I would have gotten an F. I just couldn't put all that information down in 2 hours. But it wasn't that I didn't know the material. I knew the material just fine. So what are we really testing? My ability to regurgitate something fast, or my ability to know the material?
And I think these are a lot of the questions about the standardized tests as well. You brought up the SAT. Is it really testing knowledge, or is it testing the ability to fit into their specific framework and to guess correctly the specific references they have? There's a lot of cultural biases built into standardized tests as well.
As I said, I'm very smart, and that has come up a lot. And I'm not just saying that to say it. But I don't know, I got like 1,000 on the SATs because I didn't have extra time, because my mind didn't think that way, because. And so I didn't get into any schools, except for, one or two.
And after you finished your journey through higher ed, is that when you went directly into being a librarian?
So I had a first career. Actually, I worked at a community college and some other places. My first career was in theater for about 10 years. And then I started working at a bookstore, a very famous bookstore called Politics and Prose, and in Washington, D.C. And then I just came to this realization that I had to go to graduate school. And I tried every way around it. Could I be an assistant librarian? Could I do this? Could I do that? And then just that realization that I had to go to graduate school, it was like the most upsetting thing I had. And then, what I did do is you try to work it out. So I had strategies where I said, okay, I was working full time. I had a 2-year-old, and I said, okay, well, what I'm going to do is take 2 classes of marking period. I'm going to take 2 classes a semester. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take 1 class of something I'm really interested in, like children's literature, and then I'm going to take a cataloging class, which is a requirement. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take classes over the summer, because that'll help me get through faster and there are fewer people. Another thing I did was I only took classes from adjunct professors who were library science is a very practical degree, and I wanted teachers who were in a library during the day and then teaching at night. So I wanted the very practical information. So I kept trying to find what was the way I could get through school. How could I do it? And so I did all those things. And then when I graduated, I worked at a public library as a public children's librarian, and then worked at the synagogue library. And simultaneously, I always had 2 jobs, and I was working in bookstores as well.
So higher ed had a lot of structural barriers for you.
Yes.
Where did your love of books and your relationship of books come from?
My love of books came from my mother. We didn't have a lot of money when I was a kid, and we had this very small shelf of books. Like we're talking 20 books that were on, we had them in my brother's closet. We didn't have a bookcase, and they weren't new. They had been bought at used library book sales, for 50 cents. And those were our books. And then we also went to the library, and my mother read to me and my brother every night. And that really stayed with me. And one of the books that she read was a book called The Magician, which was by this great illustrator and author, Yuri Shelovitz, who had translated that book from an original Yiddish story. And I loved that book so much, and she read it to me over and over. And many, many, many years later, I found that book again in a library, and I said, you know, I love this book, The Magician, and what if I change this, and what if I change that? You know, it was in the public domain. And eventually that book turned into The Passover Guest, which is the book I just published last year.
And with The Passover Guest, you brought it to a younger audience?
Sort of, yeah. So the book, the original Yiddish story was The Magician by Eyal Peretz, the Yiddish writer, and he had published it in an anthology for adults. And then Shelovitz had translated it and had made it a picture book as well, but my version was set in a different place and time. So instead of like kind of long ago in Poland, my version is set during the Depression in the 1930s. So there are a couple other picture books, but mine is in a different time and place than those other ones.
So for listeners, can you give them the elevator pitch for The Passover Guest?
Can you hang on 1 minute?
All right. Sure.
Because I'm not good at doing it well. Okay. all right, here. Okay. So the elevator pitch for The Passover Guest is that it's the spring of 1933 in Washington, D.C., and the Great Depression is hitting young Muriel's family hard. Her father has lost his job, and her family barely has enough food most days, let alone for a Passover Seder. They don't even have any wine to leave out for the Prophet Elijah's ceremonial cup. With no feast to rush home to, Muriel wanders by the Lincoln Memorial, where she encounters a mysterious magician in whose hands juggled eggs become lit candles. After she makes a kind gesture, he urges her to run home for her Seder, and when she does, she encounters a holiday miracle and a bountiful feast. But who was this mysterious benefactor? When Muriel sees Elijah's ceremonial cup and finds that it is empty, she has a good idea.
Well, I hope listeners will find that book. I'm waiting on your publisher to send it to me so I can read it. And we will link the books that we're going to be talking about today in the show notes so listeners can find them and learn more about them. And so we talked a bit off air about your journey to publication. You're a member of SCBWI, which is a children's book writing organization that's international and has a lot of members. And you had your own journey to get your book published. Do you want to share a bit about that?
Sure. Yes. And I really do recommend, as you said, SCBWI, Society for Children's Books Writers and Illustrators, for anyone who is interested in or has already written a children's book or illustrated one. They are a really great organization to help with the next steps. So I always talk about my journey to get published as being very unusual. Usually you, you write for a long time and then you polish it, make sure it's perfect. And then you submit queries to an agent and then you eventually get an agent and then the agent submits to the, to many editors and then an editor hopefully selects the book, and then you work with the editor and you get the book published. And my experience was not that at all, which was that what I did is I already had a, as a librarian, as a bookseller, I know a lot of people in the publishing world, and I had a relationship, a friendship with editor Neil Porter, and we had discussed this book, The Passover Guest, and he was interested. And we kept discussing it over a number of years, and then eventually, and very happily, he said yes. And over those years, he kept editing it until it got to a good point. And then once that happened, I got an agent. And then there was a contract. And so it happened kind of in a backwards way. But I wrote it for several years first. And then Neil and I worked together on it for about 6 years. And then Neil found... with the help of my agent, found the illustrator Sean Rubin, and so it all kind of came together. But the whole thing, from first word on a piece of paper to book in my hand, was a 10-year process.
And well, it sounds like a long journey. When I speak to authors, both on air and off, it's not atypical.
Right.
It's getting a book published can be a long journey, even for authors who are already published. Mm-hmm. Things aren't necessarily published in the order that they wrote them. They'll say, oh, well, I wrote this book first and I thought it was going to get published, but actually these other two got published and that one just took a long meandering path. And it's not as clear and crisp as one might think.
Yeah, I'm about 6 years into the second book, which is also a picture book. And sometimes, you know, there are things that people don't think about or consider, right? Like, you know, maybe you want, for a picture book, you want an illustrator, but that illustrator has two or three books ahead of you, so you have to wait 2 or 3 years for that illustrator. Or, you know, during the pandemic, books got delayed. Or, you know, there was big paper shortages, supply chain issues. So the book you thought was coming out in a certain year is coming out a year or two later. Books get moved from, you know, the fall season to the spring season all the time. So it's not always so clear cut. You know, so it might take like a year for the illustrator to illustrate. It might take a year for the book to get marketed and printed and all of that. So it's not, you know, well, I had an idea for a book, or, oh, well, they signed the contract, so it's coming out tomorrow. It's not like that in any way.
Your day job is being a library director for a synagogue library. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fantastic job. I love doing it.
And you recently, a few weeks ago now, wrote a tweet that became viral. Do you want to tell us about the tweet?
I did. So, yeah, it was incredibly, unexpectedly viral. As I was saying before we started talking on air, that you never know when something is going to become viral. But the tweet was about this book, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas by John Boyne. And my colleagues, Jewish librarian colleagues, and I have been talking about this book for many years, and not just us, many other people. The book has been proven to be factually inaccurate about the Holocaust. And while it's not the first book to be factually inaccurate, the issue is that it is the most taught Holocaust book. And so that in the US, and so that becomes problematic, because then a lot of children walk away with the impression that this is what happened during the Holocaust, because it's their main frame of reference. So I posted a few tweets about it, and then it became so viral that I just started answering more and more and more and more questions. And so it became quite an involved tweet. It got reposted on Instagram. So between Instagram and Twitter, it got not so far away from 200,000 likes, and in addition to, you know, 12,000 retweets. So all that was very surprising.
When I checked it this morning, it was at about 11,500 retweets, over 400 quote tweets, and over 61,000 likes. And that was on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah. And it went even higher on Instagram, thanks to this great organization called The Conscious Kid that reposted it there.
And the tweet says in all caps, "Please don't tweet, teach, or recommend the boy in the striped pajamas. It is the number one taught Holocaust book. It sympathizes with the Nazis. It is factually inaccurate." You shared with me off air that you have tweeted about that before, and like three people read it.
Right. That generally is the case. In this case, of a friend of mine was talking about, you know, she mentioned in another group that we run, she said, "Oh, you know, we should all tweet one more time about the boy in the striped pajamas because there's a sequel coming out. So we want to remind people again that, you know, as the sequel comes out, we want to remind them that this is problematic." And so I actually wrote this post on Facebook and it got 11 likes. And then I wrote it on Twitter and it just started going crazy. So, you know, it's so weird sometimes, you know.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at 3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
And while you were urging people not to teach this, you were also providing factual information. In one of the subtweets for it, you said, "We talk about the same few concentration camps and ghettos, but there were actually 44,000. It wasn't just Germany and Poland, but Jews were sent to their death from more than 20 countries controlled by the Nazis. Concentration camps started in 1933. In the tweet, you also not only provide the names of books that you do recommend, but you also provided links and pictures of book covers. Will you tell us what books you do recommend?
Yeah, so I did. So I'm, as I said, I'm a librarian and I believe in correct information. And so there were a lot of people discussing it with me, and I wanted to continue to provide links. And a lot of my friends said, "Oh, you should stop responding." And I said, "Yeah, but I can't leave incorrect information out there." So I kept responding and kept responding and kept responding. So even if I'd said something 50 times, I said it the 51st time in case there was someone who didn't, who wanted the answer, somebody who wanted the answer, because I felt so important to keep providing information. I really thought this book, the book that I really strongly recommended was We Must Not Forget, Holocaust Stories of Survival and Resistance by Deborah Hopkinson. And Deborah has impressed me again and again with her books on many topics. For example, she has this amazing book on the Titanic. I'm a Titanic expert, and I've read dozens of books on the Titanic, and Deborah's is, to me, the best. But so she wrote this book on the Holocaust, we must not forget, and it's just, to me, astonishing because it's so many different stories of different people, which is great. I believe in telling actual stories of actual survivors and what happened and showing. It's absolutely age appropriate. And it has fantastic, well-researched back matter and timelines and everything you could need. But what's so amazing about what Deborah does is that in every single story, no matter where it's set, how the story is told, she puts an element of Jewish resistance into it. And lately, we are seeing so many stories of righteous Gentiles. And righteous Gentiles are very important. These are people like Oscar Schindler who saved Jews. But those stories are told from the stories of the saviors. They're not told, like this book we had a few years ago where it was Jews hiding in the attic and there was a woman downstairs who was Christian, and she was the one that we saw the story from. I wanted to hear about the Jews in the attic, and that's what Deborah's showing us, is that Jews fought back, and yet we either only have we have all these righteous Gentile books, or the only books that we're showing kids are books that are about the camps and the ghettos, and those are so important, but we should show the full story, and we're not showing the full story. So Deborah shows the full story. And another book that I recommended about the resistance is called Beyond Courage, The Untold Story of Jewish Resistance During the Holocaust. And this is by Doreen Rappaport, who's another excellent author, and who also gives us this bigger picture that we don't usually teach.
Some of the things that came up in the thread were while teaching the Holocaust and talking about the camps and the ghettos is important, what's also important is the passivity of so many people in that time period.
Yeah, and the fact that they weren't passive. Do you mean the Jews or everybody else?
Oh, sorry. No, I was not referring to Jewish people. I was referring to people who felt like it wasn't theirs to get involved in, wasn't true, or it wasn't affecting anybody that they knew, or because it was happening in concentration camps, then they weren't involved. It wasn't their fault. They couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, that is the thing that we're fighting today. Because it's over there, because it's not happening to me. I was having a conversation the other night with a Jewish group of people, like 2 days ago, and we were talking about this, and everyone at the table was Jewish, and everyone looked around and said, "Whose attic would you hide in?" And every person said, "I know the name of whose attic I would hide in. I've already figured that out." Everyone knew. Because we know this is not long ago and far away. Everyone at that table had a valid, active passport. Everyone at that table was ready to leave the country if they had to, including me. We all know this is our life today. It's not our life in 1943 in Germany.
You bring that up in your tweets.
Yes.
Not just this one, but in other ones. That we can't look at it as something that was long ago or something that was far away. Do you want to talk about some of your more recent things that you've shared about trying to present at a conference and feeling that putting the word Jewish in the title or clearly in the presentation reduces your chances of having it accepted?
Yeah. So I think that people think that anti-Semitism is ghettos and camps or the KKK. Actually, the number of times that I've been told the KKK doesn't pertain to Jews is kind of shocking, because were they not paying attention in Charlottesville? We know the KKK is coming after us. And actually, I kind of, like, at least with the white supremacists, that's a very obvious kind of anti-Semitism, right? You know, like, there's so much that I'm not, you don't hear about. So, all right, so on January 6th, a lot of people are talking about it in this, you know, with the whole thing with the Capitol, right? A lot of people talk about it in this very abstract way of, you know, they talk about it. It was those people over there who this group of people that wasn't them, and they don't understand. Well, you know, I live in Washington, D.C., and what happened on January 6th was terrifying. That was not like a group of people over there trying to get into the Capitol. That was people 5 minutes from my house that were saying anti-Semitic words, wearing anti-Semitic t-shirts, 5 minutes from my children. Like, Jewish institutions in the D.C. area closed that day. I don't hear people talking about that. It was terrifying. It wasn't abstract. Whenever that day gets mentioned, like, there's horror that comes to me. It's like PTSD. There was a curfew that day. I guess, you know, if you don't live here, you don't see that. And I felt directly attacked. So to me, you know, there's these two kinds of anti-Semitism, right? There's the obvious anti-Semitism, you know, that Charlottesville, Jews will not replace us. And the subtle anti-Semitism coming from the other side of, you know, we need to stand up for every diversity and every group and everyone's important. Oh, but not the Jews. There's a book by British comedian David Baddiel called Jews Don't Count, where he talks about all the ways that people make clear that Jews are not important to them. They don't count. And that's what this is. So, you know, you go to conferences and you see all these great presentations and all these great diverse groups, and it's wonderful to see these presentations, and, you know, we've fought so hard to have them, and that's so terrific. But as somebody who is trying to make professional presentations at conferences, I have watched just, I mean, a dozen, two dozen, over and over, will present, you know, across divisions, across associations, with well-known speakers. We will put in proposal after proposal after proposal. We'll put in like five a year on various topics with well-known speakers with good credentials, and just five a year will be turned down. Next year, five more will be turned down. Next year, five more will be turned down. And then people say, oh, well, you know, it's so hard to get a proposal in. And you'll see the same topic, but without the word Jewish in it, be presented. And, you know, it can't be that hard just to watch our dozens of proposals be turned down. And I'm really worn out. I'm worn out. Just, you know, can't get up in front of people and speak. And whenever we do, luckily enough, get in front of people, they're like, wow, those are such good points. And we never knew that. And thanks for saying that. And why haven't you said it before? I'm like, we haven't said it before because no one will let us up here to talk. So, I don't know. It's getting old.
In your tweets, you talked about needing more books. And while the Holocaust will always be important to teach, and important to teach properly, and important to teach factually, even in historical fiction, the facts still have to be impeccable. You also need books about Jewish joy, about Jewish characters living a variety of lives and circumstances. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So this is the thing that we are always talking about. Actually, I just gave a conference presentation on it. but that was to a Jewish group. So we're always talking about exactly what you're saying about Jewish joy. You know, I have this joke, which isn't really a joke, where I say, you know, if we don't get books about the Holocaust, which right now are 1 in 2 children's books we counted are about the Holocaust. And they absolutely are super important to have books on. We just 1 in 2 is a very high number. And a lot of those are Righteous Gentile and Savior books, and just, a lot of them are kind of problematic. But so my joke is that if we don't get books about the Holocaust and about pogroms, where Jews were forcibly, had to leave Egypt. So if we don't get books about the Holocaust and we don't get books about pogroms, which were about how Jews were forced to leave Europe and violently, and that's a lot of the Ellis Island immigration stories, then we are really lucky and we get books about the Spanish Inquisition, where Jews were, forced to leave Spain at the pain of death. So those are the types of books we usually get. But we do exactly what you're saying, want books about Jewish joy. And we want diversity and intersectionality in everything, in every way in Judaism. And what I am always constantly saying is that what I want in my Jewish library is to see the same kind of books that I could see in a public library. So, a lot more graphic novels, more fantasy, sci-fi, so much more comedy, STEM, books on holidays that other than Hanukkah, books set all over the world, all forms of Judaism, like Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Orthodox, non-practicing, what I want also is books that are not long ago and far away, because if they're all set like in Poland 100 years ago, then we see Jews as other, and we don't see them as our neighbors. We don't see them as people that we're going to protect or hide in our attic tomorrow.
As a librarian, what's on your wish list? What books do you want to get published so you can put them on your shelves?
Oh, I was actually literally just reading you my wish list. but I'll include some more. So I would love to see more LGBTQ, a lot more neurodiversity of all types. I'm going to just keep saying graphic novels because the kids in my library will thank me for that. Break out from some of the Jewish tropes. So we see fantasy, but we see a lot of golems, and there are so many other Jewish figures. I would like to see more children's cookbooks and crafts and those kind of books. More Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews, and not only Ashkenazic. A lot of interfaith representation and non-Jewish parents raising Jewish children, Jewish music, theater, and arts, poetry, immigration stories that are not centered around Ellis Island or the Holocaust. Really, really wanting early readers, kind of like Elephant and Piggy, and early chapter books like Magic Treehouse. There's almost none in the Jewish world. Life cycle events that are not bar mitzvahs, and Jewish stories that have contemporary settings, depictions of contemporary anti-Semitism, like some of the ones that I'm describing, and traditional Torah stories that are not Noah's Ark or creation. And this is a big one. We, particularly in series biographies, we see books about biographies on Anne Frank, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Albert Einstein, and Harry Houdini, and they are not the only four Jews in the world.
You've named a lot of gaps in the literature. As a librarian and someone who works in advising booksellers, there's a great joy in putting the right book in the right person's hands. What are some books that you love the opportunity to put into people's hands?
Oh, man, so many. Hang on, let me...
I know it's always painful to be like, name your favorite book.
No, let me just look into my catalog real quick. 1 second. I have so many favorite books. It's really hard to... wow. I really need to make a, like, Susan's favorite list.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
What are some that you've been recommending to people recently or personally handing to people recently when they come into the library?
So many. Hang on. I'll look at my new list just a second. I mean, it's like there are dozens, right? I really should do that. Recently... Okay. So I really like the Book of Elsie. It's by Joanne Levy. And it shows contemporary anti-Semitism. It also shows Purim in a book that isn't a picture book. And it also is this early chapter book that I'm talking about. There was this great new book by Michael Twitty called Kosher Soul, which is the intersection of Jewish cooking and Black cooking. And it is really a terrific look at both those things. I like A Synagogue Just Like Home by Alison Blumenthal McGinty. This is a nice way of how the whole synagogue pulls together as a community, which I think is a really important thing. I have so many.
it's always a painful question for book lovers.
Yeah. Ellen Outside the Lines by AJ Sass has a lot of great intersectionality. There's a really wonderful new board book series by Vicki Weber, A New Week, Time for Bed, Shabbat Shalom, and Start the Day. I could name you another 100.
let's see. Maybe two more?
Two more. Hang on. Are these like favorites ever or just, I mean, I can just do my favorite. So the graphic novel that I always recommend to everybody is a book called, it's a trilogy. It's called Hirville by Barry Deutsch. And there's three books in the Hirville in the trilogy: how Mirka got her sword, which is number one; how Mirka met a meteorite; and how Mirka caught a fish. And they are just really fantastic books. They're orthodox and they're comedy, and the tagline on the first Hirville is "Yet another troll fighting 11-year-old Orthodox Jewish girl," and this is what I want more of. Truly, is that kind of great stuff. And then another series that I really recommend is a great middle grade fantasy series, which is called Anya and the Dragon by Sophia Pasternak. There's a follow-up, Anya and the Nightingale. And these are, again, just these great Jewish fantasy books. You know, these are exactly the kind of things we're looking for.
Well, you've given listeners a book list to go out and start reading, so thank you for that.
Well, and I want to recommend one other thing. There's so the Association of Jewish Libraries, which I'm very involved with, and a wonderful organization, and you don't need to be Jewish or a librarian to join, so we hope you do. Every year, they give out the Sidney Taylor Book Awards, named in honor of Sidney Taylor, who wrote All of a Kind Family. And there are fantastic Jewish books on that list in picture books, middle grade, and young adult, winners, honors, and notables. And so there's a lot to choose from. So that's the book list that I really recommend on the Jewish Libraries, on the Association of Jewish Libraries website. And I'm really honored this past year that our book, The Passover Guest, actually won the Sidney Taylor Award after I was the chair of it for many years. And it was really quite an accomplishment.
Yes. Did you read the All of a Kind Family books when you were young?
So I talk about that a lot. So I was between chairing and being on the committee and past chairing. I was involved with the committee for 6 years, and then I like completely didn't speak to anyone or anything when my book was eligible. So, which was weird, but so it was like 6 years on the committee, and right, all anyone wanted to talk about was that. And I met Sidney Taylor's daughter, and I was, you know, sitting next to her, and so many people would come up to her and say how great All of a Kind Family was, and I never read it as a kid. And I was like, what is wrong with me? Because everyone in the universe has. And so many people said, you know, it was, and a lot of non-Jewish people would say it was life-changing for them. And it was the first book they read that was Jewish. And I mean, I would hear all these things and I felt terrible that I had never read it. And I did read it when I got onto the committee, of course, but, you know, but the thing that I also said, as much as it's great, it's a wonderful book and a wonderful series, and I'm very excited. There's a new, television series coming out and I'm really excited about that. But the thing is, you know, it wouldn't have represented me. I was a, you know, Reformed Jew in Washington, D.C., and these were Orthodox Jews in New York. They weren't really me. I wouldn't have been a window or a mirror for me. I would have been a window, but it wouldn't have been a mirror for me, even though they were Jewish and I was Jewish.
Why do you think those books have endured so much?
Oh, they're wonderful. You know, they're so great to read and you feel like you know them, and the writing is great. And a lot of people do, like, that's the Jewish book that they discovered. And I think that's terrific. You know, and it was an honor to be on that committee in honor of her. And it was really quite something to win the award. That was really an incomparable moment. And there is, for anyone who is really who really loved All of a Kind Family, in addition to the books and this new series coming out, there's a really great nonfiction book called From Sarah to Sidney, The Woman Behind All of a Kind Family by June Cummings, published by Yale University Press last year, that I can't recommend enough.
Thank you for that. I didn't know about that one.
Yeah, June worked for years and years and years on that book. So,
and that's Princeton University?
Yale.
Yale, thank you. You've introduced me to so many new books today. I'm furiously taking notes while we're talking. This is a wonderful list. What inspires you?
What inspires me in anything particular? Or
well, it's an open question. If it's about, if you want to answer it in a bookish way or as a writer, as a human, it's an open question.
I mean, I think I could answer it in all of them, but I would say my children, I am inspired to make a better world, a safer world for my children, where we have less anti-Semitism, where we have more books they can read. I want them to have what I didn't have, because I have had not very many books, and I've had a lot of anti-Semitism. Not to bring down the inspiring comment here, but I did want to talk a little bit about how people do see anti-Semitism as very far away. When things happen, they're not far away from me, right? You know, when the Pittsburgh shooting happened, there was a, you know, we suddenly got a full-time security guard at my synagogue. When the hostage situation happened in Texas, we got a security firm all the time. I don't want to go deeper into the security because I can't really do that for security purposes. But people forget about these things, but they're there every day for me. The number of trainings, the, you know, it's not abstract. And I want to create a world that for my children that isn't like that. I mean, it is hard to just go to your office and feel that you are taking your life in your hands every time you do it. I don't want that to be my legacy.
What do you hope listeners take away?
Well, that. I would like listeners to take away the fact that Jews are diverse, that when we say things like, oh, it doesn't matter what's in this book, so what if, you know, this book sympathizes with the Nazis, who does that hurt? You know, it hurts me. It hurts my community. It causes people to walk into buildings with guns and shoot us. It matters a lot. And when we are sympathetic and understanding of every minority, of every diversity, I would like them to be sympathetic and understanding of Jews, who are not just religion, but who are a culture. And it's getting dangerous to live in this world. And it's getting exhausting to be the microaggressions that we're experiencing just daily over and over and over again. And then you're told that they're not, right? So that's the thing, right? You know, it's this daily struggle where on the one hand, you're being just surrounded with anti-Semitism. And on the other hand, you're being told, well, there is no anti-Semitism. Why are you complaining? And to go through that every day, hour by hour, I am so tired of that. I am tired of this constant battle. And I would like to make it just a little bit easier in the tiniest of ways. I would like publishers to turn down fewer books because the publishers are turning down a lot of these books that I listed. I would like to be able to speak up at conferences. I would like to be on panels because it's assumed that we're diverse and Jewish. And I would like this all to be easier and a lot more. And I would like to have books to show my children and other children. Anyway, I would like this not to be so hard.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Susan Cusell, and telling us about your tweet and everything that was behind it. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again.
Oh, anytime. Maybe I won't be so depressing next time.
I want you to show up as you and tell us what you have to say, please.
Thank you truly for having me, and thank you to everyone for listening. I know that my Jewish experience is mine alone, and if you're Jewish and listening, I respect that it's different from yours. And so thank you to listening to mine.
This is The Academic Life on New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, and I hope you will please join us again.